right when it goes on now to give you dimensions of how this image operates, how man in the image of God operates. What does man do? Does he be sinless? What does he do? The second half of the verse. He rules. He rules. So the function of the image, when man is doing this thing in the image of God, what he does is to have dominion. Now, what is an image? When I set up an ancient world, when I set up an idol, or an image of some god, what does that image do? Now I'm using the parallel usage concept. What does the image normally do in the ancient world? If I put up an image of Baal or of Jupiter or somebody, what's the function of that image? It's an object of worship, that's one thing it can be. What is its relationship to the God itself? He represents, right. He represents the God. And now, this is true of the king in the ancient world. When the king sets up an image on his boundary stone, here's a huge boundary for the king's empire. And he sets up his image, the image of the king on the boundary. And that image represents the king who is ruling over the empire. And if you were to deface that, you would be violating the rules and the will of the king. It would be a personal effrontery to the king. And so, the image concept means that something represents another thing. And here, too, man represents God in that, not that he's sinless or holy, but that he rules over the earth. That's the function of the image. It doesn't define the image, it simply describes what happens when it's in operation. That man rules over the earth for God, and over the birds of the sea and everything else. Now this is an extremely important statement, because in this sense, is the image of God something that God threw away? Is the image of God something that is lost? Do we still do this thing? Namely, rule the world for God. Are we still God's representatives on the earth to rule the world, to subdue the earth and fill it? Are we? We may be doing a lousy job about it. That's secondary. The question is whether it's still our job. Great. Of course it is. And this is part of the problem. When we started to say the image of God was lost according to dogmatics, we didn't mean the image of God at all. We meant sinlessness was lost. Sure, that's lost. But that's not the image of God. In the text, at least. That's something in chapter 2 or chapter 3 about sinning. Sure, we sinned. Everybody sinned. But the image of God in this sense, that we rule the world for God, we represent God on the earth. Probably going to lose our light, so look at it. We still do that. And that's very important. It's very important in the liaison between the theologian and the scientist. And so I say to the scientist, do you know what your job is? To subdue the world. To win the world. To discover the world. You are to represent God and find everything and control everything in the world for God. And you haven't seen anything yet, says God, about what there is to rule. You've only started the process of ruling the world for me. And that's not just the theologian's job. It's everybody's job. We represent God on the earth. The world, the earth is made for us. And this is a fantastic value that God puts on us, a fantastic and wonderful job. It is not just bringing the gospel, but controlling the world, and at the same time doing it according to the word of the gospel. And every time you come to a scientist, make sure that you don't assume that somehow he has a lesser job. He and you have the same job. He probably does some of this image work, this ruling, and discovering the world better than you do. In a different way. Is that clear? Let me tie this up with one other thing that's in Genesis 1. And I'm trying to here overcome a few misconceptions that keep floating around in the Western church. At least what I think the Bible is saying is these are misconceptions. In Genesis 1, what is the word that kept coming over and over and over again that God said about the world of creation? Was good. It's good. And this is good, and this is good, and even his bald head is good, and it's all good. The fact that we foul some things up, not God's fault, it's not the world's fault. And that's why I have real trouble every time I sing that hymn. The world is very evil. The world is not evil in and of itself. God made it good, and he made you the good rulers of it. The fact that we foul up the job sometimes is not his fault, nor the world's fault. And the fact that when we sin, we affect certain things in the world. And we sure did affect a few things when we dropped atomic bombs and upset the balance of nature with atomic our fallout and all the rest of it. But don't blame God for that. He didn't do that. We didn't rule right when we dropped those atomic bombs. And I never can excuse America for that. Being an Australian, I suppose I can stand back and judge a little easier. But innocent people, heaven above. But that's not the fault of the world or God. And so God made this physical world and all the dimensions of it good. And don't ever think that there's anything bad about you. See, part of our theory came in the early church. But the idea was that the good part of us was a thing called a soul, a spirit thing inside of us. And this external thing, which I call my body, and you call bodies, or whatever you call it, your thing that hangs around, that it's all you and it's all good. This is the point. They said it was evil. And it was a kind of a prison in which your good, immortal little soul was like a little blue dot, was somehow floating around inside of you. And finally it popped out when you died and got free. Because that's a Greek idea. Nowhere in the Old Testament at all. It's a Greek idea. And it is a horrible idea, because it means that this thing that we're wearing, they said, was corrupt and evil. It's not. The fact that we sin doesn't mean that God didn't make this whole thing that we are perfectly good. All of it. And it all worships in the Old Testament. My flesh worships. My whole self worships. And that's why I just love to see a dance in the church service. For once we use the whole person worshiping instead of just the mouth, you know, all you see a few words coming out with no person at all, just words. You worship with your whole being. Your whole being is supposed to worship. My flesh and my heart cry out to God. Flesh, it says. My body sings to God. Read the Psalms. Please learn to worship with your whole self. Not just put your heart into it. Put your hips into it. Put everything into it. Like the girl in the morning. See? They're on the bus now. They'd appreciate them. Yeah.
Does good mean then without sin?
Yeah, he makes it without sin. And it all depends on what you mean by sin, you see. If you mean, he makes it all perfectly good, and the whole, the cause of the sin and the distortion that comes about is the fault of man, who doesn't rule the way God wants him to rule. But his function is still, his job is still to rule. And it's all good. I don't see where anything is bad in and of itself. In the Old Testament, nothing is ever said to be bad. You don't even have any picture of a devil who is an evil force that causes the bad in the Old Testament. And we'll talk more about it when we get to Genesis 3. What that said. You see? This is the thing. And the moment you start to say yes to all the good things, and when God says good, he means everything is good. And that means, as you go through the Old Testament, the whole length and line of all the things that are there, from your shoes to your flesh to everything that there is, music especially, and song and dance and wine and the whole lot. Oh, wow, there's some beautiful songs of praise to wine in the Old Testament. Or sex. Wow, there's some beautiful songs of praise to sex in the Old Testament. Of course, in the last generation we read those, we didn't want to read them that way. So we said it was an allegory. It didn't talk about sex. It was really talking about my soul's enamorment of Christ. But gee, my soul doesn't talk that way about Jesus Christ. It's a normal song of sex. And you see, then this ties up with what happens in the second part of this thing in chapter 26. Then God blesses man so that he can rule. Verse 28, 28, yes. And God blessed them and said, what? Be fruitful and multiply. How do you do that? By contemplating? No, obviously. Some people think they can, but they can't. The only way to do that is to enjoy it. You know, to go about it and to have the whole operation of life and the fulfillment of all of the sexual desires. And you see what God did? He made the first blessing. And blessing doesn't just mean a pat on the back. It means giving you some power. The first power drive that God gave man in order to be able to rule this world was sex, you see. We had a horrible feeling, didn't we, that sex was only discovered in the garden when man sinned. It's one of the old stories. But it's there. Sex comes long before sin. Please, yes, it's part of the goodness of creation. It's part of the blessing force that enables you to rule the world, to express yourself, to be the good person that you are before God. The goodness of section and all this wonderful drive that's there. And the moment somebody tells me that that's not a wonderful drive, they somehow or another have missed life or missed something. And the moment somebody says you're not supposed to enjoy it, you know, that it's only for the creation of children, they've also missed something. Because it's for me to be able to rule the earth. And that means to reach out as a person. Now I'm interpreting a little beyond the text, I grant. But it's still involved in the whole picture. And the joy of this whole business is called love. Sexual love now, not just love in the sense of God's love. That is the outreach. And the two are somewhat more closely tied in the Old Testament than we tend to think. The so-called idea of free giving, which is not tied to sex, is of course another concept. But sex love, this part of God's good creation, is praised so beautifully in the Song of Songs. I'm going to have to read a few verses of that. We've got time to get through this today. Let's turn to Song of Songs. You should never have gone through the core source of life without reading Song of Songs, some of them. Song of Songs is a praise of love. Human love. Nothing else but human love. And it's a collection of love songs. Wedding songs and similar songs. Just beautiful. And I cannot understand why some of these songs have not been put to music. They are just beautiful songs. And every phase of love that you can imagine. Tell me a phase of love. The whole love scene. And I'll find it for you in the text. A phase of love. Anyone you like. Oh, come on. Don't be bashful now. Any phase of the relationship of man and wife in love, or of courtship, or the whole thing. Well, if you don't want to yell, spring fever. Let's take spring fever as the first one. In chapter 2, verses 8 and following, here is spring fever, when love breaks forth. You have to remember that the winter is past, but in verse 11, and we'll start. We'll start from verse 8, and I'll read it for you. The voice of my beloved, behold, he comes, leaping upon the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle, like a young stag. We still say that. Behold, there he stands behind our wall, gazing in at the windows, looking through the lattice. Not a peeping Tom, but her lover. My beloved speaks and says to me, arise, my love, my fair one, come away, for lo, the winter is past. It's spring, you see. The rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth. The time of singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard of all our land. The fig tree puts forth its figs, and the vines are in blossom. They give forth fragrance. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. Verse 15, catch us the foxes, the little foxes, and spoil the vineyards. For our vineyards are in blossom. My beloved is mine, and I am his. He pastures his flocks among the lilies. And so it goes on. That's the one, just simply one poem. But now you have a lot of other things. Not just now the joyous spring and going out with your lover, but descriptions of the beautiful, perfect girl. You know how when you fall in love, the person is, you know, just... There's nothing wrong with that person at all. It's absolutely flawless, this gal.
There's nothing wrong with her at all when you first fall in love. And so you have any number of these pictures here about people who are really in love. Let me find one here. Chapter 4, verses 1 and following. The perfect girl. You behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats moving down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing. All of them bears twins. That's two sets of teeth, of course. And not one of them is bereaved. She's got all her teeth left. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David built for an arsenal. Well, now, we wouldn't quite use that expression there. It's a little heavy, but... The imagery is altogether different, but there's a beauty there. There's a fantastic beauty, and they have a whole series of these descriptions of the beautiful girl. And so I can go on and give you a whole lot of others. Oh, the one about the don't sit under the apple tree, that's another one. One about the lovesick lover in 2 verse 5. Sustain me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am sick with love. Oh, that his left hand were under my head, and that his right hand embraced me. I adjure you, daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the hinds of the field, that you stir not up nor waken love until it please. Don't spoil it until the right time. And you can go on and on and on. There are problems about a girl who doesn't have any large enough breasts to be attractive. There are problems about a girl who is frigid. There's everything you can think of is there in the Song of Songs about love. I could give a whole series of lectures and simply start from this book on love. So it's part of the beautiful picture. God made love holy. There are also some very funny things in this book as well. All right, I digressed a little bit, but it's worth it to make you realize that when the Old Testament talks about this love, it is sex, it is part of the important phase of God's first creation, the blessing of God upon man. Now, let's tie that up, this picture of what man is and the goodness of creation, with Genesis 2, verse 7, the first phase of creating man in Genesis 2. And as we said the other day, the possibility is there that we've really got a different writer now in chapter 2. We've got a story here, rather than, in this case now, a simple chronology of things happening, but a story with a very definite plot to it. Starts in 2, verse 7. We've got the picture of the desert that we talked about, and then God makes man. Now, this is important because it ties up with what the nature of man is. God, the Lord God, formed man of dust from the ground. And the word form is important because the English cannot capture what that word means in Hebrew. The word in Hebrew is that word that is used of the potter when he takes the clay and molds it into a particular form. This is taking then the mud or the clay of the ground and molding it. The word mold would even be better than form at this point. So the picture is of God the potter, God the sculptor, or God the potter at work. And so he takes the clay from the ground and he then breathes into the clay life. And the picture seems to be that God makes this form with his clay, and then he breathes into it, presumably with mouth-to-mouth breathing, because that was the way in the days of the Old Testament when one of the ways they used to restore people. Strange that we went back to that same method nowadays, didn't we, for reviving people in terms of drowning. Of course, that's the way that Elijah revived the boy, you remember, when he was dying, a dead boy, and so on. It's an old method. You breathe your breath back into the person. And so the picture seems to be this, although it is not explicit. God makes a model and then breathes into it and it comes to life. Now let's look at it more closely. What are the parts that are made up, that a man is made up of here? He is made of what? Dust and breath. Dust and breath. Those are the two parts you get.
And I want you to make sure that you remember those two parts, dust and bread. And when God makes man dust and bread, what is he described as? A living being. If I were to ask you before you ever saw this text, what is man made up of, you would probably have answered what? What's his composition? Not chemical. Flesh and blood would be one answer. What else? Body and soul would be another answer. Now, body and soul, of course, again, is an answer that was based upon a Greek concept. The biblical concept, the Old Testament concept, is of dust and breath. The breath is simply the life that comes from God. And without God, we have no life. Dust, well, what does the dust signify? What does dust always signify? Earth. In terms of what happens to man. That which you return to. It's a symbol of the fact that man is just dust, that he dies, that he's transitory, that he will pass away. And so man is made up of the life breath of God, that which gives him life, and that which makes him a mortal being, namely that which dies. That which is alive and that which dies. Without the breath of God, we would die, and we are just dust. With the breath of God, we are made what we are, valuable men of God. Now the thing is that the text calls this a being. Now, I'm going to give you one Hebrew word. This Hebrew word is the Hebrew word nephesh. And the interesting thing is that in all the old Bibles, that word nephesh was translated soul. Soul. And in the Old Testament, a soul is not something in a man. The nephesh is not something in you, but it is you. That total being that is the combination of dust and breath. And this is a description not biologically, but in terms of what a man's relationship to God. Dust in that man is made up of part of the good earth that God made, and breath in the sense that he gets his life force and life drive from God. That's what the text is talking about. And when man dies in the Old Testament, his dust returns to the ground, and his breath returns to God. The breath is not conceived of in the sense of a being outside of the dust. Man is not a being when those two are divided. And if God, anything ever happens to man, the people of God who start again, then you have to talk about a recreation. So what does it matter if you're cremated, you see, by Old Testament thinking? What does it matter? It's dust, it goes to dust. God can always make it again. Very interesting. Now, we've all had some difficulty in the whole picture of the thinking of the makeup of man. We talk about soul as a kind of good thing. We still cling to the idea that the soul is something better, a better part of man, and that it somehow or another is, you are your soul regardless of whether you have a body or not. It's not Old Testament meaning. Even if you believe that, you have a right to believe that if you want to, on the basis of the Greek introduction to the New Testament. On the basis of the Old Testament, man is dust and breath. When you die, you become dust. Then, the picture would be, when man is made again, or if there is a resurrection concept, then it would be that God would recreate you again, make you once more the way you were before. All right, some questions now before I go on to the rest of the chapter. Mm-hmm. Yes? Let us make man. All right? I wanted to talk about that a little bit later, but this is fine. Let's take it now. Let us make man. How can we determine what it means when it says let us? Can we maybe dispense with this now? Let us make man. Who is talking when God says that? And here's the fascinating thing. God is talking to the Trinity. All right, this would be answer number one. Now, this is a reference to God the Father saying to the Son and the Spirit, let us do this. Let me ask you a question. In the days of the Old Testament, do you think that this writer knew very much about the Trinity?
I think that question is seriously for scholarly truth, and they tell me that God was not an angel.
All right, the other answer is, another answer is, angels. In that text? What other possibilities are there? We're not going to forget that one.
Well, I have other possibilities, but I think they were trying to refute the idea of there being many gods. Why do you use the word us, then? I would think they would emphasize the singular deity.
All right. It would seem to be a problem in terms of the polemic. Where is the polemic here? If you're talking about this problem of other gods, it's an extraordinary good question. That has puzzled a number of scholars. Yes. All right.
Didn't royalty usually refer to themselves in a plural pronoun?
All right. Majestic royalty. Majestic plural. That's another possibility. Okay. We've got one, two, three possibilities. Another possibility. Let us, and here he's talking to the whole world of creation. And of course, the problem is that the us just suddenly pops up. Now, the us occurs a few other times. It occurs at the beginning of chapter 11 when the Tower of Babel story comes. Remember the Tower of Babel, and these guys down there are making this tower, and they're building up and up and up, and they're going to reach the sky of heaven and storm God. And God is way up there in heaven, and he looks down and he says, you know, there's a miserable little project down there. I'm going to have to let us go all the way down and see what it is. So far down, God can't see it. That's how big the project of the Tower of Babel is, you see. So God says, let us go down and have a look at it. Again, you have the us. Or at the end of the story in Genesis 3, it says, let us kick man out of the garden, or somewhere, wherever it is. He has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. What does it mean? The us occurs three times then, in Genesis 1 to 11. And here I'm going to sort of, the easiest way for me is just to give you my answer to the question by looking at a couple of passages. I think that this man is on the right track, even though it creates a problem over against this cult question. I wouldn't use the word angel, however, simply because the word angel never was used in the Old Testament until after very late in the game. And by the word angel in the Old Testament, you don't mean simply a spiritual being. You mean a messenger. A prophet can be an angel. He could be an angel when he would be on earth. The word angel is a functionary term, which means a messenger. And the messenger could be either divine or human. That's, so the word itself only got later in our usage to come to mean heavenly beings. Let's look at a couple of passages. We talked, you remember last week, about what we call the heavenly council. How many of you remember that, the heavenly council, the heavenly beings? Most of the people are not around from last week. You forgot about that? You remember the cherubim? Remember the cherubim? How many remember those? Not many. Well, we're going to have to backtrack. Let's take a look at a couple of passages that talk about this, what we call heaven. Weren't you here last week? All right, we'll forgive you this time. The heavenly council. Let's turn to Job chapter 1, verse 6, first of all. What this heavenly council is. Job chapter 1, verse 6. I don't know. If you can find it in your book. Page 529. Book of Job. Chapter 1, verse 6. Now there was a day when the sons of God, now the sons of God can't be the good boys over against the bad girls, as it is often said. The sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan was amongst them. In other words, these are beings that come into the presence of God
And one of these beings was a guy by the name of Satan, which means the accuser or the adversary. And it's simply a name at this point. It doesn't mean anything more than that he was the one with whom God had the dialogue and a bit of a tussle there. And God gave him a job, namely to pull all of Job's life away from him, excepting his very essence. Now, notice this picture in Job of the sons of God and the heavenly beings coming to the presence of God. Let me give you another picture of these heavenly beings, and there are a lot of them in the Old Testament. Psalm 89, verses 5 to 13. We have another description of all these heavenly beings that are around the throne of God. And the thing is important in relation to the question this gal asked, this violent volleyball player over here, that these heavenly beings are, although they have given the name of sons of God, and although you might say it seems like God is operating with other gods now, these heavenly beings never get to do anything excepting hang around the throne of God. They are never identified with the sun or the earth or the moon or any of these other forces of nature. They are untied from all of nature, as was true of all the other gods. And these beings are simply sort of reflections of God's presence. They sort of expand God in his glory. And they are these heavenly beings around God, around his throne. Now let's just look at them in chapter 89 again. Psalm 89. Let the heavens praise thy wonders, O Lord, thy faithfulness in the assembly of the Holy One. Now the Holy Ones is another name for these heavenly beings, this heavenly assembly of holy ones. For who in the skies, we're talking about the skies now, not down on earth, can be compared to God? Who among the heavenly beings is like the Lord? So my name for them normally is heavenly beings. I don't use the word angel because this somewhat sweetens the connotation and changes it to what we use by the term. It means these beings, forces, they can be cherubim, images, or seraphim, or whatever you like, around the throne of God. God feared in the council of the holy ones. This is called the council. And Jeremiah, you remember, said, if you guys had ever sat in the heavenly council, you would know what God's will is. And then says they are great and terrible above all that are around him. The Lord of hosts, and the hosts often refers to precisely the same thing. This set of heavenly beings that surround the throne of God. Now I want you to turn to one other passage. And then we'll have it all pinned down. You've got at least an image of the heavenly beings. Job 38, verses 4 to 7. You remember God comes out of the whirlwind and he blasts Job, really blasts the poor guy, and puts him back on his heels, and he never has a chance to answer God at all. God clobbers him. And God says in verse 4, "Were you around, Job, when I made the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have any understanding. Who determined its measure?" Oh, I'm sure you know, Job. You must know. "Or who stretched a line upon it? On what were its bases sunk?" Remember the picture of the mountains, which are the bases of the earth, sunk down. This is one of their images. "Who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together, and all of the sons of God shouted for joy." Who was around when God was sinking the foundations of the earth? Who was singing? Sons of God, the morning star, the heavenly beings. There's another name. The other translation of this in the other place was the heavenly beings. So the heavenly beings are hooping it up there and saying, wow, when God is making the earth. They are part of the process. It never anywhere says where or how they were created, and I guess it doesn't really matter. And this is another thing about Genesis 1. He wasn't talking about creating everything and all of the questions we raise, but his problem, which we talked about on Monday. But now, or yesterday, whenever it was, here, all these other beings are with God. They are empathetically, joyfully, ecstatically involved in the process of making the world. And it would seem to me, if somebody says the angels weren't there or the heavenly beings weren't there, they have missed the point of Job, that God, with his heavenly beings, was enjoying this whole process. But they didn't have anything to do with being identified with the sun, and so the polemic is pure. Excepting that when God finally now comes to the last big act, he says, all right, everybody, pay attention. Let's
make man. And sometimes when I get up and say, let's do this, I mean, I'm going to do it, you know. There's an empathetic, sympathetic involvement of all the heavenly beings in this final great act of God. And so this is why I would say that it refers to the heavenly being. And this is what's meant also in chapter 11. And it is strange that this us just occurs in these contexts. It doesn't occur elsewhere all over the place in the Bible. If it were a majestic plural, why isn't it used all over the shop? You see, why just here? And one other proof that I would adduce that this is the right answer is that in the story that we read the other day about the Babylonian story of creation, when this picture comes to making man, the council of heavenly beings makes the decision together. And so here we have a common image that is similar to that which is found elsewhere in the ancient world, that the heavenly beings are combined with the great God in the final act of creation. All right?
You said it doesn't matter how or when they were created. It seems to me it does matter.
Well, in this case, it would seem to suggest that it was they were there when the creation of the world was taking place, right? But it doesn't tell us whether God made it five a day before the rest of creation, or on the first day, or before the first day. It doesn't say that, and I don't think we should try and answer that question. That they were made by God, ultimately, this is, of course, all that we need to affirm.
What
it does is to say to the outsider or to the Israelite who become an Israelite, none of these beings, these heavenly beings, can be worshipped. They are nothing but reflections of God's glory. They are nothing but servants of God, and none of them are worshipped. And nowhere in the Old Testament are these heavenly beings addressed, spoken to, prayed to, worshipped, or recognized as gods. God alone is God, and these beings which in the mind of the outsider may well be a lot of other gods in Israel were just made human beings, just made subservient creatures. Let's look at one other psalm to make my point. Psalm 82. This is a story about these heavenly beings that went off key. God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, these are the heavenly beings, another name for them, he holds judgment. He says, how long are you going to do the wrong job? Judge, that means look after a certain territory. Give justice to the weak, maintain the right, etc. But he says, verse 5, they don't know anything, they are nuts, they walk in darkness. Verse 6, I say you are God, sons of the Most High, that's another name for them, all of you, but you shall die like men and fall like any prince. So this is the fall, the condemnation of some of these heavenly beings in Psalm 82. So they get put in their place. And if this is the kind of attitude that Israelite can have towards these beings, they're certainly not gods in the sense that they are rival deities at all.
Well, that would be the first one.
Yes, and that's right. I don't think that the Israelite writer, the idea that the Messiah, that the second person of the Trinity, that we call the second person of the Trinity, that Messiah was a divine figure who was called God, is a revelation of the New Testament. The Old Testament sees this great figure coming and any number of dimensions. And suddenly the New Testament comes and the people of the New Testament call him my Lord and my God. This is a claim that is just blasphemous in the ideas of the Jews. It's one of the blasphemy things that he was crucified.
But in a sense, they are looking for the Messiah. So couldn't that statement have been true in the eyes of the Jews in this respect?
They were looking for the Messiah, but they did not. There's no indication that they believed the Messiah was part of the Trinity or that the Messiah was God. That's the difference. One thing to look for a Messiah who was God's Savior, whom God will send. Another thing to suddenly realize that this Messiah is really one in whom God dwells. That is a leap of faith that the New Testament made. You see, that's the problem.
If you believe that the Holy Spirit was just the writer,
yeah.
Then why did Paul say that they were just the
Yeah. See, the sun is used in the Old Testament, sons of the prophets, doesn't mean actual sons. It means the guild of prophets. Sons of the musicians means the guild of the musicians. Sons of Asaph means the sons of all the priests at the temple. It means not actual sons, but that corporation, that group. And it means those belong to a certain group. And son doesn't mean automatically physically begotten or divinely begotten, but it means belonging to a certain cohesive group. And so there, in essence, we are sons of God too, by adoption. But we can also, that's a good name you could have, sons of Holden, or daughters of the Reformation, what do we call them? Daughters of, what is that thing, the American Revolution? Daughters of the American Revolution, now they're not real daughters, obviously. I mean, physically, this is a, use the term in a wider, so the term is used in a wider sense. Okay, any questions now? So that answered that question and took us 15 minutes, but that's all right. The picture then is of God finally creating the whole thing in concert with the heavenly beings. Now let me take the rest of chapter 2 and survey the most important elements of it, and we'll leave chapter 3 for tomorrow. You remember we talked about chapter 1 in a way that was primarily emphasized as the structure of this thing and the super very carefully worked out pattern and so on. Chapter 2 and chapter 3 are a unit that starts as a story now. And here you've got more of the kind of short story element where you've got a narrative and a very definite plot and development running through, and not the kind of structured arrangement that we had with the other one. 6 days with three and on each side, you remember, and two things on each of the third day and the sixth day, and so on. This kind of structured arrangement is now gone. And now we have a story form. And just because we have a story form, however, doesn't mean that we've eliminated the possibility that the writer is doing the same thing in some way as was true in chapter 1, the parables of Jesus. Suddenly Jesus starts off and he says, a man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho and he fell among thieves. What do you call that story? Yeah? What kind of literature? Parable. Jesus didn't start off by saying, I'm going to tell you a parable. He started off by saying, a man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho. But you know it's a parable simply because it is a typical story and it tells the truth. And it may very well be that a guy went down there and fell among thieves. And Jesus is taking the story. Could be a historical thing. And some of Jesus' parables are based on actual history. So now we're going to start looking at the same sort of implication. I use the word parable here because it's a word you understand. And the writer wants to make a variety of important points about the nature of man from the very beginning. He first of all wants to make the point that man is the key figure, that he is the most important figure in all of this creation. And so, how does he do that in chapters 2? Many of you read it. How does he do that? Huh? What? All right, it's the first thing that God makes in this whole sequence. He starts off then with man. That's the whole point. Let's put these on the board so that it'll help you to understand what he's doing. The man is the key figure, that he is the important one in this whole business. And so he makes man first. And so the order really doesn't make a scrap of difference. He gets man first, and then the waters, and the garden, or rather the other way around, and then the animals, and then the woman. But because he wants to make the point that man is the key figure, and that he comes first, he creates him first. He starts with man, the whole business. He also wants to make the point that man is mortal, so that he has a complete picture of man. What does he do to show that man is mortal? What's the picture there? He's made out of? Right. He's made out of dust. He also wants to make the point that man gets his life and his drive and everything from God. And how does he do this in the story? All right, so we have the breath of God to describe precisely that point. He wants to make the point that man has a special relationship to God or a special responsibility over against God. What is the special relationship over against God that man has that the animals don't have? What does man, God do to man that he doesn't do with the animals? What? Well, no, that was back in chapter 1. Now we'll go back to chapter 2 now. Don't try and read chapter 1 into chapter 2. All right, he talks with him. He addresses him. He has communion with him then, which is not true of the animal. He talks with man. And this is very important. The moment you start talking to man, you treat him as a personal being. There's a relationship of communion and of love and some a few other things that are implied by the fact that God addresses man in a special way, so that there is a special relationship. The special relationship is not primarily that man has a soul and that the animals do not, as some people often said in connection with the Old Testament. Because, you see, animals are also made out of dust and breath, and animals are also called living beings. They are the same physically as man is. The difference is not in the physical structure of man, but in the fact that God has condescended to give man the special value of communing with him, of making him something, by talking to him, by giving him the ability to commune with him, to talk with him, to address him. Call it mind, call it whatever you will. I don't care. This is not the physical thing. It is the relationship that's important, that God has established with man, that he has not established with the animals. All right? Now, the next thing, how does he want make the point that man has authority over the animals then? That man, like in chapter 1, has dominion. He has authority. In chapter 2, how does he express his authority over the world, the animals, and the rest of the world? Now, that gives God special relationship. Gives God. That's where God gives his order. How does man indicate, yeah? Right, he names the animals. And when you name something, when you give something a name, what does that indicate? Huh? Right, you have power over it. For example, when an artist creates a piece of something, this is a good illustration, you know, and here is a modern artist, and he's going to create a thing. And you look at it, you say, yeah, mm-hmm. And everybody else looks at it and says, ooh, yeah, mm-hmm, yeah, yeah, ooh, yeah. And you say, well, what is it, artist? And he says, it's a hippopotamus. Everybody says, yeah, it is a hippopotamus, isn't it? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I guess it does look like a hippopotamus. Now, it doesn't always work. But that man's naming of the thing, that man's making of it is somehow indicates his power over it. And this is much more true in the ancient world. When you knew the name of somebody, you knew you had some control over them. The Egyptians, for example, they would take a pot and they wanted to curse somebody. And so they get that person's name. What's your name? Listen to that. She won't give me a name. We'll call her Diane. All right, I like Diane here with the mustard sweater. All right, I put it on this pot, this red pot. Now I want to curse her. From here the kingdom come. So I've got her name on there, and you see the name is an extension of who she is, an extension of her personality. It's not just a name. For us it can be just words, but for them it never was. And so I smash the pot. See? And pronounce a few oaths, and she is cursed, and it will automatically have its effect on her, according to their thinking. Because the name is an extension of the being, the person. And so, when you know the name of someone, or if you know the name of a god, you've got some control. And it's more so the case when you give somebody its name, you indicate that you rule them. And so the naming of the animals in chapter 2 is the indication that man is ruling over the world of the animals and so on. All right, now he wants to make the point, a little bit further on, that there is a very close bond between man and woman as well. Close bond between man and woman. It also indicates that the animals are supposed to help man because man was looking for them as a helper.
How does he indicate that there's a close bond between man and woman by the story form? Anyone? Yeah. Makes woman out of him, right. He makes woman out of him. And where does he take woman from? From his rib, from the heart. You see, and that supposes the center of his emotional, religious, and everything else. You see, in the Old Testament, you don't think, there's no word for brain or mind in the Old Testament. You think with your heart. Out of the heart proceed evil thoughts. There is no biblical word in Old Testament words for brain. And so you always are thinking, who has known the mind of the Lord? The word mind there, of course, is the Hebrew word heart. So you go on. Very careful then, you don't think in terms of our idea of thinking up here. The emotions and the thoughts are all tied up together. And so he makes woman out of the rib. That's very significant. He makes her out of the rib, that which is closest to man, not out of his foot. Or out of any other part, you know, which would indicate subservience or being sat on or anything else. It indicates that he comes directly from the heart. Okay? That's important to remember. Now also, he wants to indicate that there is no sense that man at the beginning had no sense of guilt. How does he indicate that with the story form? What is there in a story would indicate there's no sense of guilt for the first man and woman, right? Yeah, they were naked, but without shame. Normally, you see, nakedness was a symbol of shame and disgrace and rejection in the Old Testament. But now he comes along and says, these people were naked, but they didn't feel anything wrong with it. See, and that's a wonderful feeling. And it's like a girl in a pond miles away from everywhere. You know, she gets out there and choo, it just goes wild. Well, that's what I hear anyway. But the point is clear. The point is clear. And then later on, the moment that they sense, how does he make the point that they feel guilt later on? What must they do? Cover their shame, cover their nakedness. And so these story things, which were really easily understandable even for us today, these little things from the story make this point come through. And he wants to make these points, and this story form is the simplest and easiest way to describe man as he is seen right from the very beginning. Now, we could go on and look at a lot of other things in chapter 3, but the same sort of thing happens in chapter 3, where he wants to make the point by using a kind of story. I want to make one other point about woman before we stop here. Although it's woman who is the first one that gets tempted in the story, and then woman becomes the medium of man's temptation, ultimately, this writer sees woman not in any sense as though she should be subservient to man. It is often thought, you know, this is a biblical picture, that because the Bible says that the woman should serve the man and shut up in church and a few other things like that, that she is somehow weaker than man or something like that. Now, when the story continues in chapter 3, and the woman, the temptation is over, then God places the curses upon the snake, and he's got a crawl on his belly, and the curse lies upon the woman, and she has extra pain when she has children, and the man has extra sweat when he makes food. These are things that man has brought upon himself. But now all of these things are curses that ought not to be. These are not eternal decrees that are unchangeable. These are things that ought not be that way. And so when he suddenly says that woman, where is that verse? Your desire shall be for your husband and he shall rule over you. That is the abnormal relationship he's talking about. Not the way it should be. The way it has become because of the evil that has developed. And the writer of Genesis is very explicit, it seems to me, when he's picture of creation. He ends up with the finale of the woman. See? Man is a key figure of mankind, but then in his story, woman is a glorious climax. And at the same time,
when he looked at the curses, the fact that woman in his society got to be subservient to man was not what he wanted. Was not the ideal. It was the distortion of the ideal. And it is our role to overcome that horrible distortion. All those curses.
Why should we just let them be and be fatalist about it? They are things that we are supposed to struggle, like we had to struggle with the snake and everything else, and overcome these as we rule the world before we return to dust.
So woman's role, ideally, is not to be subservient. And it depends on what culture you came from as to whether or not this is a curse. Some of the cultures of the ancient world, you see, women were in charge of the shop. What we call matriarchy. To some extent, that is true in some Negro communities in Africa, as you well know. But you see, Rachel and this group, Rebecca, they came out of the matriarchal society. And the fantastic thing about it is that Rebecca would leave the society where she was boss to go and live with, who did she marry? Rebecca. Isaac, right? Who was nothing by any standards. All he did once was to palm her off with his sister. Never did anything else of interest. Isaac. And she comes back and leaves her society where she would become a big shot, you see. She would rule her tribe to become the servant, the wife, at least, of Isaac, where she would be subservient. So we have this whole question. And all the curses, too, are curses that are understandable in his world, in his culture. If you lived in the midst of the jungle, you know, this whole business about thorns and thistles and really struggling to get a little bit of plant to grow out of a dry ground wouldn't make much sense to you. See, these are curses that are written from the point of view of an Israelite in Palestine, where things are pretty rugged and it's hard to get things to grow, and thistles are more problems. And the like. And snakes are common. But if you're in Ireland, you know, where there are no snakes, this is kind of a strange story. See. All right, so be it. Well, this is the whole point then of Genesis 2, that this writer wants to make this quite clear, that God now makes man with this special relationship. He is addressed with the ability to communicate with God. He is given what he needs. He is pure in the sense that he hasn't sinned yet, the created beginning. This is not part of his image. That's a different concept in chapter 1. Chapter 2, he is talked about as being sinless. That is, he has no shame. There is no alienation. There is no break between God and man. No hostility. And he can be around completely naked. This is his symbol of the man's innocence, nakedness. Of course, if you take other stories of the fall, you don't have to have people naked if you don't want to make this point. If you read Ezekiel 28, which we'll look at tomorrow, there the first man is not naked. He's got the clothes of a king on. You want to make a different point. So you don't have him naked. See? So be very careful that you don't make these details the end in and of themselves. The points you want to make are made clear in this story form, and it's a story form that is so simple that even today it is clear, I think, that the main point comes through. Well, I'm going to stop there. I'm not going to start with chapter 3. Let's leave it open for a couple of questions, and then we'll quote. Any questions about, generally, the main point of chapter 2 that I surveyed at the end of the lecture? Anyone? Yes, ma'am. Well, there will be no peace in the world while man is man, of course. But Paul has a passage where he talks about everyone becoming one in Christ Jesus. There'll be no Jew or Greek. Everybody becomes one. He uses this a couple of times. And the idea is that in Christ, all of these distinctions of the special relationship to God are removed. The idea that woman is somehow or another not as closely tied to God is out, but there's any range or division. In Christ we are all one, we're all in the same level. We are all bound and bought by him. And this concept is true. But then that there would be peace on earth, that's tied up with another one. It's all going to really mean peace between God and man, or peace on this earth. And peace on this earth, of course, is not going to come until all are at peace with God. And that, of course, is not happening. because not even you and I can always live at complete peace with each other, because we are what we are. Free people. And we make choices. The moment you make a choice, you're going to have to please one person, that and another. You cannot please everybody. If you don't make any choices, you cause more problems. If you make some choice, and you have to make a choice, and you have to decide that whatever choice you make, and if a gal makes a choice, she's happy that one guy's happy and the other guy ain't. That's all there is to it. It's as simple as that. And the whole life is made up of choices, and you have to realize you've got the freedom to make these choices, and you cannot give in. You've got to make a choice and fight the battle. It's going to happen every day. We have this horrible feeling that I can avoid the choice. You can't avoid the choice. You've got to make it.
I have a question. How do you feel about this passage where God says, you may eat of all of the fruit of this...
We'll talk about that tomorrow.
...of knowledge. Some people have a concept that this is where man's conscience came into being.
No Hebrew word for conscience. No Hebrew term for conscience either. This is an interesting concept of the later time. But something comparable to it is involved in the Old Testament. We'll look about the trees tomorrow. And I'll ask you to think about the trees. Read chapter 3 carefully. Read Ezekiel 28, the last half, if you want to also, as a parallel chapter. And think about the trees. What kind of trees are they? And then we'll have a little puzzle tied up in chapter 3, which has a few extra trees thrown in for good measure. All right? Any other questions? Yes, ma'am. Well, there are a variety of descriptions of this process of God. In the Old Testament, the picture is at death we disintegrate, and there's a kind of a flittering shadow of me that continues down in the depths of the earth. That's about all. And that only at the end of the Old Testament period is there any picture of recreation or resurrection. Ezekiel 37, which talks about the remaking of the people of God, is precisely in this concept of the recreation of them. Here is this valley of bones and stuff. Maybe the Negro spiritual is tied to this, remember? And the wind, the Spirit of God, blows through that valley, and clunk, clunk, bone to bone, the sinews come on the bone, and there is flesh. And then the breath comes in, and they come back to life, and they're recreated again. So recreation would be the one concept that would be possible for the Israelite to think about if he were talking about life after death. And he normally never talks about it. He doesn't talk about heaven or life after death. He talks about living with God now, which is concerned. And if he did, it would be in terms of recreation, because this is his way of understanding man. Man is not primarily a being, an entity, a kind of a blue flame, which is really me tied up inside of a thing called a prison of the body. That's the Greek idea. The Old Testament idea is that I am a whole. I am animated earth, a mortal being from the very beginning. God alone could give me the gift of eternal life. It's not inherently in me. It's a gift from God. Don't think you earn it or have it. God alone can give it to you. And you can give it, he can give it to you only by being in the right relationship to him. Well, the difficulty is with the New Testament interpretation that it's half Old Testament and there's a certain measure of Greek influence. You see? And it depends on whether you have your orientation from the Old Testament approach to the New Testament, or whether you approach it from some of the Greek ideas that came in later. And when Paul in chapter 15 of Corinthians starts talking about the resurrection, let's look at it for about 2 minutes, or you can look at it yourself if you like. He does exactly the same thing. He doesn't talk about a reunion between an id called the soul and a body that God is going to make. He talks about the recreation of us in Christ. And he creates, says that there'll be a creation of a new body, a new being. What kind of body? Let's take a verse. Start with verse 35. How are the dead raised, some people say? What kind of body will they come with? You foolish souls. When you sow something, it has to die before it comes to life. When you sow is not the body, but a kernel. So what we sow, our mortal self, it will not be what's going to be recreated. This is something new. We have a new creator. God gives it a body. Verse 39, for all flesh is alike. There is one kind for man. I'm sorry, not all flesh is alike. One for man, one for animals, another for fish, one for heavenly bodies, terrestrial bodies, with one glory of the sun, etc. So verse 42, with the resurrection of the dead. What is sown is perishable. You die, mortal creatures. You are raised up, immortal creatures. Imperishable. Verse 44, sown physical, raised a spiritual body. Not just like you are now. It's going to be different than you are now. Something's going to happen. You see? This is Paul. This is good Old Testament thinking. This is not a being that is put into the old body. There's a recreation of you in a dimension that you won't understand yet. You, somehow, but it is a spiritual body. So, if there's a spirit physical body, it's got to be a spiritual one. Verse 47, the first man was made from the earth, dust. The second man was made from heaven, Christ. And maybe he also implies us also. As was the man of dust, so are those who are the dust. As is the man of heaven, so are those who are of heaven. That will be us. We won't be dust anymore. It'll be something else. Read that whole chapter carefully, and I think that it fits exactly the picture of the Old Testament. The dust man, the mortal man, is remade the immortal. This is Paul's picture, anyway. Not quite the same as other pictures in the New Testament, but it's consistent with Old Testament thought. The Old Testament thought doesn't take the next step and say, we're going to be remade immortal. It simply leaves us with the physical body. It's a big question, now, which the New Testament gives an answer to. Help you? And so don't start worrying about what's going to happen to your soul between the day of die you die and the day of judgment. That's a foolish thing to meditate upon. If you die in God, you die in God's hand. And God the Creator can make you however and wherever he wants to. Right? Yeah. One more question. We'll call it quits.
Where do some people, or some religions, get the concept that it's against the rules or it's
I don't know what the finicky problem is. I think it's just an aesthetic sensitivity for many people. And some religions do have some rules about it. Now, I don't really know what the situation is. I guess tradition has it, but of course you bury people in the Old Testament too. If your body is not buried, if your blood, if you don't get a proper burial, it's kind of like a curse, and the blood cries out to heaven for murder, for vengeance, and so on. This old idea. But that, of course, no longer of any significance to us. That's simply an idea of that time. So if you want to give your body to research, do so.
Well, great. I was wondering where we got the idea from.
Sure. By the way, when you die, you can will whatever you like. It's a good point to make. When you die, you can will whatever you like, you know, of your property, your shoes, your glasses, the gold in your teeth, to anybody you wish, but you have no jurisdiction over your own body once you die. You cannot will your body to either be cremated or for what he calls for research. Only your relatives have jurisdiction over your body. You have none.
Why is that?
You ask the lawyers, don't ask me. It's a fact. And because that's a fact, make sure that when you're, if you're about to die, or you think you're going to die one day, make an arrangement that you have an agreement with your wife or with your family that you want this done to your body. If you want it taken to research, and the more they need them, I mean, fantastic amount nowadays. If you want to give your body to research, and I urge you to do so if you have a half of an inclination, give the body, it has to go right away, you see, immediately. You call the organization and the hearse, the ambulance takes you up to this place and they see you no more. So if you don't want to have people lying and dripping tears on your body or a number of other things, depending on how you feel about death, there's so many different emotions tied up here.
And so many people, mother says, all right, mother, we promise you, we'll give you your body for research. But as soon as mother dies, they can't part with mother, you see, and they won't honor her request, and she has no say over it. Either before she dies or after she dies or in her will or anyway. That's the way it is. There is no say over it. You have no say. So you've got to have a bound promise from somebody who's your friend. This is what you want done. And it's good to have one of those little things in your wallet, too, if that's what you want.
I've got one little thing in my wallet. Also, USC School of Medicine, and you sign it away for witnesses.
Good.
When you're alive.
Yeah, that's good.
I say, in other words, you as an individual can give to a medical school.
Yeah.
You have it all legally signed before you die.
Yeah, there are still difficulties, but usually the relatives will not try and contend that if they know that you've really made the... And if it's best to do it with a specific organization. The trouble is, of course, if you die in another country or something, it's a problem. But if you die within reasonable proximity of the place where you're going to give it, you use the School of Medicine, great. More and more people are doing it.
But the organization doesn't need to accept you at that time, except the body if they don't need it.
I have a right to say, no, we don't want to. But why shouldn't I? You say they've got a roster for 50 bodies, you know, and 45 sheets they've got to fight over. What more do they need? Sure. And sometimes people die in groups. That's right. There's no point in putting it in your will. Simply urging your relative, you have no jurisdiction, of course, once you die. And your relative dies simply pressured into it by your will often. They don't know anything until they do it. Yes, the trouble is if you put in your will and they read the will a week later, you know. But you see, you have to operate with the days of the week. The second Saturday is the seventh day from the Jew. And so the fifth day is the Thursday. It doesn't help that, does it?